From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. After 4 long years of deliberation, 191 countries at the World Health Assembly in Geneva, Switzerland, are close to adopting an ambitious new treaty meant to control the global use and sale of tobacco. It would be a great victory for world health advocates, a giant hit for tobacco companies, and a head-turning new step in global regulation. But in the 11th hour, the United States is threatening to back out tonight. The global move to rein in big tobacco and U.S. objections that may bring it all down. We begin with an overview of the World Health Assembly's tough treaty provisions. Allison Langley has been covering the negotiations in Geneva for the New York Times. I asked her to describe the significance of the treaty.
It's the first time ever that the World Health Organization has negotiated a treaty that's specifically on a health issue. So this is why it's really significant and very meaningful, at least for people in the health world, that something meaningful comes out of this treaty.
And Allison, what are the specific measures that this treaty would mandate or require?
Okay, well, what it would do is put a comprehensive ban on advertising, supporting, and promoting tobacco products.
Worldwide.
Worldwide, where it is allowed by constitutions. And that's a clause that was added by the United States because we have very tough First Amendment laws in the United States.
Okay, and what else would it do?
It would also impose high taxes on tobacco products. It insists that companies be held liable for their products. The tobacco industry would be obliged to divulge all the ingredients in their products and print warning labels that cover at least 30% of the package.
So it's a big warning.
Yeah, and a lot of them are saying, you know, pictorial as well as written. The treaty will also ban companies from using misleading terms like ultralight, and it encourages nations to fight against cigarette smuggling and to enact strict clean indoor air laws.
So this is a very sweeping set of measures that the treaty would take. So this week then, and the United States, I guess, has been involved throughout, but this week the United States stood up and said, wait a minute, what are the objections that Washington is now raising?
Well, in any international treaty, you can do one of three things. You can say, we adopt this treaty with no reservations at all. You can say, we adopt it with a couple of reservations on this clause or that clause. Or the treaty can be completely mum on the wording of whether you can have a reservation or not. And if you're mum, if there's no wording in the treaty, then that allows countries to have a reservation. So what the United States is trying to do is say, we don't want to have any wording at all on this treaty so that we can take any exception on any part of the provision that they should so wish.
And so would any other country. In other words, any country who signed on could also refuse to implement any portion of the treaty.
That's right. And that essentially what people are saying is if you allow that, then there's no teeth to this treaty at all.
What particular measures is the United States concerned about?
Officially, they have not stated. What we do understand, however, is that there are three provisions which Washington is concerned about what they say are constitutional federalist issues.
And those are?
One, it's setting minimum size on the warning labels. They don't like that, and they're saying that that's a prerogative of Congress, not the executive office. They're saying that prohibiting the free distribution of cigarettes, which is also a part of the treaty, is up to states to decide, not up to the federal government. And finally, they're saying defining what constitutes an advertisement violates the First Amendment.
So if the United States says we want any nation which signs on to this to be able to ignore any portion of it, what's the sense of the meeting in Geneva? Would this leave this a gutted treaty? Is it still worth passing? I think you've written it was anticipated it would pass within a month from now. Will it still? And if it does, will it mean anything in that form?
The EU, for instance, they said that they felt it was a very balanced compromise that came out of 4 years of negotiations, and that the EU, for instance, was totally against reopening negotiations and allowing reservations. When I spoke to the Brazilian ambassador's office, the Brazilian ambassador is the person who chaired all the 4 years of negotiations, and they were also against opening negotiations. That doesn't mean it won't happen. It just means that there's a bit of opposition. And what people who would be for this, they're saying that at least this is a way that the United States could sign on to this very important treaty. That also holds a lot of teeth.
You quote Matthew Myers, president of the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, saying that the measures the U.S. is demanding would be a poison pill that would kill the whole treaty. What does he mean by that?
it means that anybody can opt out, and it wouldn't be a meaningful treaty.
Now, U.S. negotiators are saying, as you quote them, that they support a strong treaty here. So do the steps the U.S. has taken this week indicate strong support for the treaty then or not?
You have to understand that the United States is the number one donor or contributor to anti-smoking programs throughout the world. So the U.S. has a very good record of supporting a tobacco-free world. We have some of the toughest laws, not the toughest, but some of the toughest laws in our nation, and we put money behind our words as well. What the U.S. negotiators are saying is that they're very dedicated to the idea of a strong treaty, but their belief is they can't get it through Congress because of these federalist issues.
Are other countries at the meeting there interpreting this as an American matter of principle or as the American government running interference for the tobacco industry?
It's gotten to be a very emotional issue. And I think what you'll hear from a lot of the lobbyists here is that they really feel that the United States is putting up a good fight for the tobacco industry.
If Washington sticks to its guns on this, just in practical terms, Allison Langley, how is this likely to play out? Are negotiations likely to be reopened? And if they're not, then what?
I think it would be difficult for negotiations to be reopened because if the United States tries to reopen negotiations, then there might be other nations who would want to renegotiate other points of the treaty. It's a funny situation. What people are saying in Geneva is if you have this tough treaty, then there is a chance that the United States may not adopt it. And then what kind of an international treaty is it without the United States in it?
Allison Langley, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Allison Langley is a correspondent for the New York Times. She joined us from Zurich, Switzerland. It's been a long 4 years, but after endless debate, compromise, and urgent pleas, 191 nations of the World Health Assembly have neared adoption of a tough new international treaty that, if passed, would radically change the way tobacco products are marketed, sold, and even used around the world. The treaty aspires to constrain exploding tobacco use in the developing world in particular, and all the predictable health problems there of smoking. But the treaty's provisions are also a challenge to sovereignty, to national control of how citizens sell, buy, and use tobacco, and to a huge global business that is hungry for customers. Do we need a global treaty clamping down on tobacco? Would you welcome global oversight of tobacco marketing and use, or should that be each country's own responsibility? Should Washington be looking out for tobacco growers in Kentucky or for 10-year-olds in Bangladesh? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Assistant Surgeon General Kenneth Bernard, who is the chief delegate for the U.S. delegation to the Framework Convention for Tobacco Control in Geneva. Good evening and welcome, Kenneth Bernard.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. Thanks so much for joining us. Kenneth Bernard, the U.S. has been saying for some time, wait a minute, we can't go along with this global ban on advertising. Now it seems to be, this whole debate seems to be reaching an end point, and the United States is throwing on the brakes, saying it needs an out for countries that can't live with this treaty. What's the big problem here?
Well, I don't think there's a really big problem here. What we have is a terrific treaty. By and large, the United States supports about 99% plus of the provisions. Some of them are very strong. Most of them are basically bringing the rest of the world up to some of the restrictions and the control that we have on tobacco in this country. We're really pleased to see this treaty, and we've been a strong supporter of it from the beginning. We've always said that we're negotiating in good faith to get a treaty that we can both sign and ratify. And so we fully expect that this treaty will be signed and ratified by a vast majority of countries around the world. We're just talking about some issues that we have related to our federal laws and constitution that make it easier for us to deal with if we have the ability to have a few reservations on two or three very small components of this treaty.
But you must have heard the apocalyptic language out there, people saying this will bring it all down, this will sort of throw the brakes on. Even the Washington Post, in its editorial you probably read, said that the clause you're looking for that would allow every country an out, I guess, from any or all provisions would effectively weaken this strong treaty into a series of suggestions. Do you agree, Kenneth Bernard?
No, I don't. I mean, treaties for years have had reservations clauses in them that allow reservations. Treaties aren't brought down by having reservations. According to the rules on reservations from the international treaties, reservations are not intended to bring down the intent of the treaty. They're meant for very specific reasons. They have to be very focused, and in our case, what we're concerned about are very, very narrow issues that won't affect any other country except our own.
Are you concerned that if there are outs left in, and I guess that's what the United States is insisting on, that any country can pull out or not observe any particular portion of the treaty, that economic interests will ram tobacco down the throats of countries that do not have strong tobacco, anti-tobacco legislation?
Oh, I just, I find that really hard to believe.
You find it hard to believe that big tobacco would spend a lot of money in the United States or in the third world to push its products?
No, they certainly do that. That's not the problem. I'm talking about whether or not big tobacco or anybody is planning on trying to make a large number of countries completely gut this treaty. I've not had any push to gut this treaty. Everyone who's negotiated there has been extremely supportive of a strong treaty. It's that we have some very, very specific legal issues. Remember, all the issues that Allison talked about, and by the way, she gave a fairly balanced description of this. I thought it was quite good. All of our issues are legal and constitutional. They have nothing to do with tobacco. We could be talking about lawn furniture. It wouldn't make any difference. The issue is these are legal issues related to federalism and the First Amendment. We have these same issues with any treaty we're involved in. We have some of the strongest laws on tobacco in this country, and we pushed for some of the strongest provisions in this treaty. You might note that we wanted a ban on exposure of children to all secondhand smoke and in public places, and we were turned down flat by this group.
But the treaty,
understood.
Understood. But the treaty, as it stands, as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, does permit countries to walk away from provisions that might conflict with their national constitution. Doesn't that solve the American problem?
Well, this treaty doesn't write their laws. The treaty law that is in this current document does not meet our constitutional requirements. We have a very, very important document that we run our country by and that we do our international relations by, and the Constitution, we don't like it to be messed with. And in this particular case, there are minor changes that we asked for in the drafting of this that would have fixed it for us, single word changes in most cases, that other countries just refused to do, even when we carefully explained why we need those single word changes.
Why do you think you're getting that pushback from other nations among these 191? No idea. You spent a lot of time there.
Well, I did, and I don't want to imply that other governments, what the reasons were for other governments taking stands. I'm a bit perplexed because, again, the issues that we objected to don't really have a lot of applicability in a lot of places. We, for example, there was a big argument over whether people or peoples, for example, should be used in the document, whether it's plural or singular. And we have some reasons related to human rights where we want a particular word used instead of the other. And we got a tremendous pushback on that for no special reason. It had nothing to do with tobacco.
Kenneth Bernard, stepping back for just a second, you're Assistant Surgeon General in the United States. How do you balance legal and health issues here? And do you see tobacco as becoming a kind of global pariah like opium or marijuana or cocaine? And should it?
Well, I'm not a big tobacco fan. In fact, I lived in Switzerland for 4 years, and we used to plan going out to dinner into the restaurants where we could avoid the tobacco smoke. That's true in France. It's true in a lot of countries where we have much better situation in the United States than are in many of the countries that are criticizing the United States for not playing ball with this treaty the way they want us to. I don't think there's necessarily a lot of conflict. We have some strong constitutional and federalism issues in our country that do not necessarily apply elsewhere.
Kenneth Bernard, we've got it. We're out of time. We're going into a break, but I want to thank you for joining us tonight.
Okay, thank you.
Kenneth Bernard is Assistant U.S. Surgeon General and Chief Delegate to the Framework Convention for Tobacco Control. We're talking about a global move to rein in big tobacco. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a global move to rein in big tobacco and U.S. objections that may end up clipping its wings. You can join the conversation tonight. Do we need a global treaty clamping down on the global marketing of tobacco? We regulate opium and pot internationally. Is it time to make tobacco a global pariah? And do you welcome international oversight of tobacco marketing and sales, or should that be each individual nation's job? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined now from Ann Arbor, Michigan, by Kenneth Warner. He's professor of public health and director of the Tobacco Research Network at the University of Michigan. Good evening and welcome, Kenneth Warner.
Good evening.
Thanks so much for joining us. Kenneth Warner, you've attended a lot of these sessions in Geneva on this tobacco treaty. You've seen the debate there, and you've seen the debate now migrate back into the headlines in the United States. What's going on here? On the one hand, we have anti-tobacco advocates saying the U.S. is putting a poison pill in the middle of this treaty. On the other hand, you just heard Kenneth Bernard, Assistant U.S. Surgeon General, Chief Delegate there, saying no such thing. We're very anti-tobacco. We've just got a couple concerns here to bring it in line with the U.S. Constitution.
I thought that the reporter from the New York Times, Ms. Langley, actually gave you a pretty good overview of what's happening. It is important to keep in mind that Dr. Bernard is a diplomat, and he was speaking to you like a diplomat. I found a couple of his comments rather disingenuous. Let me give you an example.
Please.
He said, we pushed hard for a ban on the exposure of children to environmental tobacco smoke, mm-hmm. and we were shot down on that. In point of fact, what happened was other countries were pushing for a ban on smoking in all public places, and the U.S. delegation came back with a restriction of smoking that children would be exposed to, and that was it. So, frankly, the U.S. delegation was taking what I guess I would call very aggressive and very arrogant stances about what the rest of the world should be doing. They've created a very unfortunate situation in which the U.S. is not viewed favorably by pretty much anyone coming out of these negotiations.
So at this point, given the U.S. pushback, what are you anticipating here? What's likely to happen? Is this treaty going to go through without a U.S. signature? Is it going to collapse under the weight of U.S. Standoffishness?
I feel like I have more knowledge of what's going to happen in the stock market than I do about the U.S. and this treaty.
It's still that unclear.
It is unclear where it will end up, in part because it is unclear how firm the delegates will stand when they get to discussing this at the World Health Assembly. If they stick with the rules they had accepted in advance, then nothing will be brought up for renegotiation unless there's a sizable population of countries out there that want to renegotiate it, and that looks extremely unlikely. You've got to remember that some 171 countries signed on to this thing at the end of the last negotiating session. There's great support for this worldwide.
It on the face of it, it looks like a fairly radical document. As Alison Langley said, it gets the World Health Organization involved in a global health treaty for the first time. I wish you'd take us through some of these provisions. It would bring a comprehensive ban on advertising and promoting tobacco products. So I guess no more magazine ads, no more billboards, no more free cigarettes given away at bars anywhere in the world?
Well, that would be the idea, except that in a country like the United States, which may or may not, but the people believe it has a constitutional prohibition of banning speech for legal products, it wouldn't apply there. That's covered within the treaty. One of the major objections of the U.S. delegation was covered, and it was covered a long time ago, early on in the negotiations.
But just looking at this globally, do you expect that in most countries around the world, post-passage of this treaty, cigarette advertising would go away?
It certainly would if countries complied with the provisions in the treaty, absolutely.
It also would impose taxes on tobacco products, high taxes as described by Alison Langley. How would that work? Who would collect these taxes? Would it be each national government's job to collect taxes as a way of discouraging tobacco use?
That's correct. Almost all countries, if not all countries, already tax tobacco products. The recommendation in the treaty is that tax rates be increased to discourage smoking, because we know that price increases are a major deterrent to smoking, especially among children and especially among poorer people.
It would require print warning labels that cover at least 30% of the cigarette package. That's much larger than U.S. warning labels right now.
That's correct. And one of the reasons that the tobacco industry opposes putting on serious warning labels is that if we move toward a model such as the one in Canada or in Brazil right now, where half of the front and of the back include warning labels with very graphic pictures, it's going to make the product unattractive. There's a bundle of research that demonstrates that smokers do not see the U.S. warning labels at this point. They're oblivious to them.
They just look right past them. But a third of the package, that's practically would require the front or the back to be a warning label almost in total. And just going through the rest of these provisions, because they're quite striking, it would require tobacco companies to divulge all the ingredients in their products. Now, that's something they fought in the United States for a very long time.
That's correct, although they are required to divulge their ingredients to the Department of Health and Human Services. They do not have to divulge them publicly, although many of them have done so on their websites. Mm-hmm. Philip Morris listed all the ingredients in its cigarettes on its website.
And there would be restrictions on the air quality, indoor air quality. Would that amount to a restriction on indoor smoking globally?
Sure, it definitely would do that. I don't know the specifics of the provision to know whether it would require bans everywhere. I believe it would require significant restriction everywhere.
So, Kenneth Warner, if this should pass, and as you say, no one knows right now, but if it should go through and be adopted, in your mind, how big a moment would that be? How significant?
This is potentially one of the most important measures in public health history. Just to put this in perspective, I believe you heard that cigarettes are killing some 4.9 million people a year around the world today.
Mm-hmm.
And another 20 years, we're looking at 10 million. During the current century, cigarettes will kill 1 billion people if things go on as they have. This is the first time, and I think it's significant that WHO chose cigarettes as the first time that they decided they were going to use their treaty authority. They've always had that authority.
Mm.
They've never implemented it previously, and now they're doing it. We're looking at a situation here. I mean, let me put this into perspective, if I may.
Mm.
Cigarettes, at least in the United States, are legal due to a combination of historical accident and regulatory exception.
Mm-hmm.
Smoking was widely diffused, you know, millions of people doing it before its dangers were known. And we had tens of millions of addicts that made it impossible to ban the product. And frankly, I personally philosophically would be opposed to banning it. And I think our experience with prohibition suggests that bans don't work in situations like that. But then we look at what's happened in the regulatory mode in the U.S. There are perhaps a dozen federal laws and agencies that would have to ban cigarettes if they simply applied their mandate to cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
But in all cases, they have either chosen not to do it, or they have been instructed explicitly by Congress to exempt cigarettes. So we've got a unique product here, and it requires some tough measures. Nobody's proposing to ban smoking, but we are proposing to essentially create what is a public health vaccine for those countries that are not already so far into the smoking epidemic that there really is little hope for them.
Big tobacco is an important industry. It's an important American export. It's an important contributor in American politics to both parties. Something near $6.5 million in 2002 to campaign chests of Republicans. When you look at what's going on with the U.S. pushback here, do you see this as a principled stand in favor of constitutional issues, as Kenneth Bernard describes them, or do you see something more commercial, more cynical going on?
Well, in fairness, I think it's both. I firmly believe, and I don't doubt this for a moment, that if the administration signs the treaty, they want to bring something to the Senate that the Senate will ratify. And they are concerned about provisions in the treaty that the Senate or some senators would find objectionable, and therefore they might not choose to ratify it. So in that sense, I think there's an element of truth to this. But it is truly hard to imagine that if we supported 99% of the treaty, as Dr. Bernard said we do, and we cared about this issue and gave it the importance that we ought to, that we would be talking about the kind of objections and blockage that the U.S. has created throughout the time of the negotiation. This isn't something new. This has been going on since the beginning. Mm-hmm. And the fact of life, whether we like it or not, is that tobacco is about as prominent in the current administration as is the energy industry. There are a lot of people very high up who have extremely close ties with big tobacco.
Listeners, you can join this conversation. Is Washington standing up for principle here or for big tobacco? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Kenneth Warner, you were at the negotiations in Geneva representing the World Bank for part of that time. What's the World Bank's interest in this issue?
The World Bank actually has gotten very interested in tobacco over the last half dozen years or so, and concluded several years ago that they would cease to fund any new projects that involved tobacco agriculture and the like, or cigarette manufacture. The World Bank undertook several studies looking at the economics and the health effects of smoking and became convinced that this is such a crucial pandemic in terms of global public health that they had to do something. They produced a report that was entitled Curbing the Epidemic, Governments and the Economics of Tobacco Control, which has been widely cited and widely used by the delegates at this meeting in trying to develop sensible, cost-effective interventions to reduce tobacco smoking.
And if this treaty should be adopted, and it looks like it's in trouble with Washington's stand, but if it should be adopted, do you see this as the first in a new generation, a new era of global health-related treaties? Could this transform the way public health law is made and administered around the world?
Well, first of all, I think the real risk here is not so much that America won't sign, but rather that they will manage to screw up the process of getting the treaty signed. Many of the delegates from other countries said to the U.S. delegation, why don't you just leave, get out, and allow the vast majority of countries that want to be involved in this and want to sign it to do so. So clearly that's one possibility. The U.S. may simply opt out, and there would probably be other countries, a few other countries, that would opt out as well, just not sign. We'd still have a very strong treaty. Mm-hmm. The risk here is that they do manage to get certain aspects reopened. I mean, the whole idea that that they could decide which features of the treaty they want to accept or reject, if that becomes part of the treaty, then it would be very much watered down. I can't imagine that this is going to set a precedent that is going to be pursued in many instances with regard to global health issues, because it was an enormous effort, at great expense, enormous planning went into it. And, you know, we're talking about what 20 years from now is going to be the leading cause of death in developing countries, as it already is in developed countries today. We're talking about a unique product and a unique public health situation. Maybe there will be other public health treaties, but this one is the one that should have been done first.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Kenneth Warner, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Sam Kasman, joining us from Washington tonight. He's general counsel for the Competitive Enterprise Institute, a free market advocacy organization. Good evening and welcome, Sam Kasman.
Hi, good evening.
Sam, thanks for joining us. You've heard the debate over the global treaty on tobacco marketing, sale, use. The United States is raising objections to this that some say may end up gutting the treaty, or the U.S. may simply be on the sidelines. What's your view? Should the U.S. be standing up to push this treaty through, or should it be dragging its heels now?
Well, I think the U.S. ought to be standing up to push this treaty over a cliff. I mean, in my view, this treaty should never have seen the light of day, just because it handles all these issues which really don't have to be dealt with on an international level, and it puts them exactly on that stage. I mean, look at this treaty. It's going to ban advertising. It bans free distribution. It encourages litigation. It encourages the raising of taxes, and it actually gets into the micro-editing of warnings, talking about just how much space on a package they ought to take up and how frequently they should be rotated if a country has different languages. There's no reason that any of this has to be done by international agreement.
Now, are you saying that because you're kind of a free market advocate and health be damned? Or where are you coming from here?
In a sense, yeah. And I'd say there are two basic principles for tobacco regulation. The first is adults have a right to take the risks of smoking, and it's government's job to make sure that adults are not deceived about those risks. And secondly, no distribution and no sales whatsoever to children. I think those are really the only two legitimate issues for government regulation. And I look at what's happened in the U.S., in the light of this master settlement agreement between all the states that concocted what, in my view, were incredibly spurious suits, except for the fact that they were brought in very convenient state courts.
You mean the American states that have brought suits against the tobacco industry and won big settlements?
That's right. Well, I mean, and they all came up with this national settlement agreement, which basically pushed the industry into this government-sponsored cartel, which is milking smokers for all they are worth. And it's already putting pressure. The advertising restrictions in that agreement, we're already seeing that it's putting pressure on the First Amendment in this country, despite the fact that this is a purely local agreement.
But Sam Kasman, you know, if there's an enormous social cost to cigarette smoking, doesn't that give societies a right to step in and legislate? And if it's an international problem, why not an international solution?
Well, no, the fact that if there's a social cost, if there's a social cost to people not getting enough sleep, I don't think that gives any government at any level the right to step in and mandate minimum amounts of sleep per night for adults.
So are you for free sale of marijuana, of cocaine? Where do you draw the line?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting issue, but I'm here to debate tobacco and not marijuana, though I'd be glad to be invited back on another show like that. But first of all, on this question of social costs, in this country, the debate was essentially over whether when you light up, are you paying society's real costs or are you imposing costs on everyone else? And if that's the case, don't the local state attorney generals have the right to recover that? And I think the best analyses indicated you were not imposing costs because the fact that you, if you were a regular smoker, you had an 8-year shorter life expectancy, meant you'd be drawing far less out of Social Security and retirement than your non-smoking neighbors.
Kenneth Warner, this is the language that we heard in Czechoslovakia, where I believe it was Philip Morris reported to the Czechs that they would actually be saving because they'd have Czechs dying
young. You know, unfortunately, Philip Morris was a little late to that game, and I think lots of other people recognized the deadly effects of smoking long before Philip Morris, certainly. And that's going to be a lingering problem for them. But I'm certainly, I think those are very clear. And once you take that into the analysis, and folks like Harvard Professor Kip Viscusi have done exactly that. It turns out that when you look at what smokers pay in taxes, they currently pay far more than their own wage. So I do not think that there is a social cost problem here.
Kenneth Warner, we've just got a few seconds here before the break, and we'll come back to this. But top line, Sam Kasman says, hey, let them sell the tobacco. It's people's and nation's individual decisions.
Well, he said two crucial things at the outset of his comments. He said government should make sure that adults are well-informed and children shouldn't be permitted to smoke. Especially if we start talking about the developing countries, you've got a pretty horrendously large problem here. Adults, including physicians in many of these countries, are not at all well-informed. Governments are very much in bed with the industry in these countries, and in fact, it's much bolder than it is in this country. It's well concealed in some instances in this country.
Kenneth Warner, stand by. We've got to take a short break. Sam Kasman, we'll be right back. We're talking about a global move to rein in big tobacco and U.S. objections that may clip its wings. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a global move to rein in big tobacco and U.S. objections that may clip its wings. A major treaty effort mounted in Geneva, Switzerland, would have far-reaching effects on the global tobacco industry. It would impose a comprehensive ban on tobacco advertising. It would impose new taxes on tobacco products. It would require tobacco companies to divulge all ingredients, to have warning labels on cigarette packages that covered at least 30% of the packaging, and so on. Lots of impact here. What do you think? Can poor nations ever resist big tobacco if big nations don't sign on for global limits? Have we reached a point where global health needs outweigh individual national agendas? And are you ready for WHO oversight of American tobacco policy? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight from Ann Arbor, Michigan, Kenneth Warner, professor of public health and director of the Tobacco Research Network at the University of Michigan, and from Washington, Sam Kasman, general counsel for the Competitive Enterprise Institute, a free market advocacy organization. And joining me right now from Pembroke, Massachusetts, Doug's calling. Hi, Doug. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say I've been listening to this discussion. I'm not up on the particulars of the treaty, but I find it ironic, tragic, annoying, frustrating, and I can see why so many Americans and the rest of the world have a kind of cynical, humorous look at America and its international politics. I remember times when we were so adamantly opposed to the policies and practices that were taking place in a lot of South America and Central American countries regarding their export of recreational drugs. And I'm sure for those countries who were economically starved in many cases, those were huge revenue generators, whether they were generated legally or not. But
Doug, you know, at the top of the hour, we heard from the chief U.S. delegate to this treaty negotiation. He said, look, this is a matter of principle, not of crass commercial interest. You're not buying that?
Well, I think it is a matter of principle, but the principle that we should be discussing in that case is the principle of what's good for the goose and the gander, and we tend to look past that sometimes. One of the previous gentlemen said something about, I'm not here to discuss drugs, I'm here to discuss tobacco. Well, guess what? Tobacco is a form of drug, as are many other things, and I'm not advocating that we should or shouldn't legalize or not legalize drugs or tobacco, but we should look at these things and try to be a little more fair, and we probably would have a lot more grace in the eyes of the rest of the world and maybe have a lot more political clout.
Doug, we've got it. Thanks for your call, Doug. I appreciate your calling in. Kenneth Warner, how about the attitude in Geneva toward the United States at this point? Doug's an American citizen expressing some unhappiness. What are you hearing from other delegates there? This isn't the first treaty the U.S. has walked away from.
Allow me to give you a very personal reaction, and I do so simply as someone who was there observing. I was not there representing the United States, but I felt like the ugly American. The attitude, the arrogance, the bullying of the U.S. delegation, I felt, frankly, appalled by it. And I know from conversations with literally dozens of other delegates that they felt that they somehow have to get around this big behemoth that just won't go away.
It sounds like an American reputation that goes back to Kyoto at least being built on, and not in a positive way there. Stacy's calling from Boston. Hi, Stacy. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
Good. Yeah, my name is Stacy Folsom, and I'm a national organizer with InFact, who is an official NGO with the World Health Organization. And I'm concerned that the U.S. is still trying to unravel this entire treaty, and it's developing countries who will benefit the most and who have really led the way toward this treaty. And I think we have to ask ourselves, who's going to benefit from the unraveling of this treaty? And I think it's really, you know, Philip Morris, Altria, who have, you know, early on in this process hired a PR firm to advise them, and the firm said specifically if they couldn't stop it, they should water it down and delay it, and that's exactly what we're seeing here.
Have you seen up close, Stacy, how that's going on?
Oh, absolutely. There's a letter that the U.S. has been circulating to countries across the globe right now, urging them to help delete a very important, critical piece of the treaty, which is around reservations. And you know, the U.S. has
reservations. That is that would allow countries to say, well, we want to opt out of this or that provision.
Exactly. Doing so very much behind the scenes, and this has been their what they've said all along, and it's critical right now that the U.S. doesn't succeed.
Stacy, there's another front row perspective. Thanks for sharing it. Sam Kasman, in your view, is that the proper role for the U.S. government, that they should be defending the interests of tobacco companies in the name of free enterprise?
Look, I think the more important issue are the rights of smokers and the rights of adults to choose risky activities, and to a certain extent, the whole legitimacy of our legal system. Because, look, even if we sign this treaty, even if we do not ratify it, even if we just sign it, it's going to become part of what's called customary international law, which essentially means that someone in another country who's got a gripe against Philip Morris because, say, its labels do not meet the technical requirements of the 50% coverage of the package, could actually sue them in an American court. I mean, this happens under what's called the Alien Tort Claims Act, a two-centuries-old clause which is already being used by some plaintiffs to try and enforce the Kyoto Global Warming Treaty, even though we haven't signed that. And I don't see any reason to internationalize the whole litigation crisis that we've already got in this country.
Sam Kasman, we've got some terrible problem with your line there. I'm going to let it go down for a moment, see if we can fix it. Stan's calling from New Glarus, Wisconsin. Hi, Stan. You're on the air.
Hi. 50 years ago exactly, I served with the United Nations Army in Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And I am tired of 50 years worth of UN bashing by this nation. And my opinion, the purveying of tobacco is a criminal act. I'd let the rest of the world work it out and make it a criminal act, and that'll be it.
You're saying, U.S., get on board here, join the rest of the world.
No, I'm saying I don't care how we do it. If we keep our nose out, the rest of the world is going to do the appropriate thing, and that is criminalize the purveying of tobacco rather than making it a civil act and people suing things and that kind of thing.
Oh, there's an angle. Stan, thanks for your call. Kenneth Warner, how about it? Do you see in this conversation tobacco gradually being positioned as a kind of health pariah that would end up leaving it aligned or in the same camp as marijuana, as illegal drugs?
Well, there's no question but that it is a health pariah in this society and in many other developed countries as well. Frankly, we need for it to achieve that status in the developing countries. I started to mention earlier, the poorest countries of this world, which is the one place where we could prevent the tobacco epidemic from really taking hold, virtually no one understands the hazards associated with smoking. It's portrayed as being the purview of the rich, the famous, the athletic, the glamorous, just the way it was here back in the 50s. And we're going to hook new generations of kids. Mr. Kasman talks about adults being able to make decisions to do what they wish to do. This is a matter of children being prevented from adopting what becomes a very addictive behavior. I mean, we're talking about a drug. It's not a question of tobacco and other drugs. Tobacco is a drug.
So what are you looking for in the weeks ahead to tell us if this is going to go forward in some form or collapse? What are the signs we should look for from afar, Kenneth Warner?
Well, I think we clearly have to focus in on the debate that occurs at the World Health Assembly. Probably if the U.S. and the other countries who are objecting get a foot in the door in this debate, then there could be a problem. If, on the other hand, the rules that have been adopted to this point are simply reaffirmed by everyone there, we don't have a problem. It will essentially be voted on, and the vast majority of countries will adopt it, will vote in favor of it. I want to point out again that we are, in essence, trying to impose our sense of what is philosophically correct, our sense of governmental structure, on 170 other countries who have told us, as well as the rest of the world, what they want to do. They've signed on to this. They all agreed this is what they want to do at the last negotiating session.
So the U.S. is as the odd man out there. And if the U.S. ends up sidelined and kind of alone here, will the treaty still be effective?
Well, there's a question about whether would we be completely alone. There are other countries that have objected for various reasons. The Dominican Republic is very much on our side. Germany holds a very key card here because Germany is opposed to the notion of a comprehensive advertising ban. And working with the EU, which tries to work by consensus, they could create problems for the rest of the EU if they balk on that one.
So open up a little light, and a lot could come in there. Kenneth Warner, thanks so much for your time with us tonight. It's been great having you.
Thank you very much.
Kenneth Warner joined us from Ann Arbor. He is professor of public health and director of the Tobacco Research Network at the University of Michigan. And we heard earlier from Sam Kasman, general counsel for the Competitive Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. To no one's surprise, Florida Democratic Senator Bob Graham officially declared himself a candidate for president in the 2004 race yesterday. Speaking to a crowd on Main Street in Miami Lakes, Florida, Graham attacked President Bush on something that most other candidates have shied away from, his record on homeland security. Graham also assailed Bush's economic record and said that as president he would, quote, bring America back. Here are excerpts of Senator Graham's speech.
We should bring America back. First, by placing an emphasis on protecting our own citizens. I know firsthand, as the former chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, how little this administration has done to provide real security at home while it's directed its attention away from the war on terrorism abroad. It is time to bring America back. And most of all, friends, we need to bring America back together. This president sought office claiming to be a uniter, not a divider. But he has united us only in the pride that we feel for our fighting men and women. Otherwise, he has pursued a divisive domestic agenda. He has talked the talk of diversity and opportunity, but walked away from doing anything to promote them. As their friends at corporations like Enron pillage the economy and the retirement hopes of millions of Americans, as the stock market robbed even more millions of their savings, as executives raise their salaries while firing their employees, this administration has answered all of those challenges with damning indifference. Friends, we have divided our nation between the few at the very top served by this administration and the many who are left to fend for themselves with the moral equivalent of duct tape. We have increasingly become two Americas. We must become one America again, an America energized with enthusiasm, an American that continues the never-ending adventure of expanded democracy, an America that looks to the dawn and the spring, an America whose sights are always higher, never lower, an American whose aspirations are greater, never lesser. That is why I am today declaring that I am a candidate for the President of the United States of America.
Florida Senator Bob Graham declaring his candidacy for the presidency in Miami Lakes, Florida, yesterday. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Support for this